Well, our theme for 2025 is Live Like Jesus. And it comes out of the simple desire to follow Jesus and to learn better what that means. We are spending the entire year in the Gospel of Matthew. Now, we began very slowly with the Beatitudes, with just 12 verses in Matthew 5, spent 2 months on those 12 verses, and you can find that on our website or on YouTube. But now we jump to the last chapters of Matthew's gospel. 2 weeks ago began the season of Lent. Lent is 40 days leading up to Passover and Resurrection Sunday. It is a time of self-examination and a time of repentance. And it's during this time that we follow Jesus through the events leading up to the crucifixion and resurrection. It is a time that is normally referred to as Passion. Now, Passion in the English language, we think of it as being a strong feeling or an emotion, but Passion in the Latin comes from the root meaning suffering. And the season of Passion is really a time to allow ourselves to experience what Jesus experienced as he fully entered into our human experience. We want to fully enter into his passion, into his experience. Philippians 3, 10 and 11 in the New Living Translation says, I want to know Christ and experience the mighty power that raised him from the dead. I want to suffer with him, sharing in his death, so that one way or another, I will experience the resurrection from the dead. So we began in Matthew 25, and the last time I spoke here, which was 2 weeks ago, I talked about the parable of the faithful servant. We want to be that faithful servant that God can trust to multiply what he gives us. Now, before that, Pastor Lester Zimmerman talked about the bridesmaids needing to keep up their supply of oil, oil being a symbol of God's presence while we wait for his return. And then last week, Pastor Darrell spoke about having a vision of God, which also is our relationship with God. He was essentially on the same theme, although he wasn't in the same passage. Today I want to talk about fellowship with Christ. We want to have fellowship with God through Christ. Think about the early Christians. The church, they shared everything in common. They shared meals, they shared prayers, they shared our lives, just like Carrie wants to share our popcorn with anybody who wants to come. You know, they didn't just meet on Sundays or on Saturdays. They were daily in each other's lives, rejoicing and perhaps occasionally also bickering, you know, like siblings do. In Matthew 18:20, Jesus says, "Where two or three gather in my name, I am there with them." So it essentially paints a lighthearted picture of Jesus crashing our parties whenever we are together in his name, whether serious or just having fun. He joins us. He joyfully joins us as we do life together. And that creates a beautiful picture of fellowship with Christ, where through each joyful moment or even disagreements, we grow closer with him as we grow closer with each other, like one big, imperfect, but happy family. These chapters leading up to Christ's death and resurrection are full of contrasts. There are some brilliant and powerful moments. At the same time, there are some shocking and gut-wrenchingly hard moments. And the disciples go through some ups and downs right along with Jesus. And as Matthew is recording these moments, they're happening in rapid succession, even simultaneously. And it's like, at any given moment, you can't really tell, is this one of the ups or is this one of the downs? It's all happening so fast. So today's text, we are in Matthew chapter 26. It's going to highlight some of these stark contrasts. The contrast of the human nature between selfishness and surrender. The contrast of relationships between loyalty and betrayal. And the contrast of our response to God from denying self, as Jesus did, to denying Christ, as some of his disciples did. And following Christ in his passion means observing and often feeling the contrasting experiences and the contradictions sometimes occurring at the same time in our own minds and in our own hearts. And in the middle of this, we're going to celebrate communion, placing ourselves right in the middle of the story and sharing fellowship with Christ. So first, let's talk about selfishness and surrender. If you're following along in the insert in your bulletins or online in your e-bulletin, that's our first point. Let's look at the contrast between selfishness and surrender, beginning in Matthew chapter 26. When Jesus had finished all these sayings, he said to his disciples, "You know that after 2 days the Passover is coming, and the Son of Man will be delivered up to be crucified." Then the chief priests and the elders of the people gathered in the palace of the high priest, whose name was Caiaphas, and plotted together in order to arrest Jesus by stealth and kill him. And they said, "Not during the feast, lest there be an uproar among the people." So Matthew 26 opens with Jesus' interaction with his disciples, and at the same time, there's an interaction happening between the Jewish leaders and the high priests. Jesus is trying to warn his disciples about his upcoming crucifixion. And of course, they didn't understand what he was saying until afterward. And Matthew notes that Jesus says his crucifixion is coming because Passover is also coming. Now, if you sign up and attend for our Passover meal, which I encourage you to do, you're going to see how Jesus is the Passover lamb, the one who was slain for our redemption out of slavery. And Jesus alluded to that comparison before it even happened. Now, right now, one of my things, as I'm walking in the morning and I'm trying to walk for exercise, I listen to the Bible Project podcast. That's one of my favorites. Right now, they are going through the Exodus story. And not just the Exodus story in Exodus, but the way the Exodus story is retold all through the scriptures, over and over again, through the prophets and even in the New Testament. Because it's all a foreshadowing of the story of Jesus and the redemption that he would lead us in. So how does this story remain hidden? Well, because in Jesus' day, all the eyes were on Israel's leaders. You know, Jesus was not a popular person in his own time. You know who was popular? The high priest. The high priest was the one who was leading the people. And historically, the high priest was not just a religious leader, but he was the one who led revolutions. He was the one who negotiated with the Romans and with the Greeks to keep the Jews from being assimilated by other nations. So, what is the high priest doing in this account? Well, he's trying to arrest Jesus. Why? Because Jesus is stirring things up. He's attracting too much attention, and that's going to threaten their positions of power. It may even come to the attention of their Roman governors, which is something they didn't want. Now, Jesus is facing one of the greatest conflicts of his life, and he is facing it head on. And the leaders of the people, the supposed leaders of the people, what are they doing? They are running from conflict. Let's get rid of this guy. But, let's do it quietly. Let's not attract too much attention. Let's just keep pretending everything is okay. And here's your first fill in the blank. Selfishness is, first of all, keeping up appearances. The Jewish leaders were all about keeping up appearances. Why are appearances important? Well, because you have power as long as everyone thinks you do, right? You are in control as long as everyone assumes that you are in control. And you have a perfect reputation as long as no one knows anything different. And against this backdrop, what Matthew reports next is going to be absolutely scandalous. So let's pick up in verse 6. Now, when Jesus was at Bethany in the house of Simon the leper, a woman came up to him with an alabaster flask of very expensive ointment, and she poured it out on his head as he reclined at the table. And when the disciples saw it, they were indignant, saying, "Why this waste? For this could have been sold for a large sum and given to the poor." So, here's what's happening. A woman comes to the banquet where Jesus is dining and anoints Jesus with expensive perfume. What's wrong with this picture? Well, first of all, let's begin with a woman crashing a party that is supposed to be men only. Okay? Luke tells us even more about this woman and what she did. Luke 7, 37 to 38. "Behold, a woman of the city who was a sinner, when she learned that he was reclining at the table in the Pharisee's house, brought an alabaster flask of ointment, and standing behind him at his feet, weeping, she began to wet his feet with her tears, wiping them with the hair of her head, and kissing his feet and anointed them with the ointment." So, this wasn't just any woman. This was one of those women. And she's not just pouring oil on him. She's getting pretty personal about it. And she doesn't seem to care what anyone else is thinking. And oddly enough, neither does Jesus. So Jesus is dining at the house of a Pharisee, one of the leaders of Israel, not one of the temple leaders, but one of the populist leaders, who apparently doesn't want to embarrass his guests by calling out Jesus in front of everyone. So, you know what you do. When you don't want to call somebody out, you raise another issue, something that everybody is likely to agree on. This perfume is expensive. And since this is a guy's party and nobody here really cares what you smell like, wouldn't this money be better used for charity? After all, giving a big gift to charity will probably get you noticed more than being the best-smelling guy in the room. This is wasteful. There's a better way you could spend this money. But they didn't get it. The extravagance was intentional. The humiliation was purposeful. The demonstration was meaningful. It was an act of worship. And that's the next fill in the blank. Worship is a selfless act of surrender. Let's pick up again and look at Jesus' response. But Jesus, aware of this, said to them, "Why do you trouble this woman? For she has done a beautiful thing to me. You will always have the poor with you, but you will not always have me. In pouring this ointment on my body, she has done it to prepare me for burial. Truly I say to you, wherever this gospel is proclaimed in the whole world, what she has done will also be told in memory of her." This is not wasteful. This is beautiful, Jesus says. If you want to make something beautiful, you don't do it on the cheap. This is not just a party at a house of a Pharisee. This is a prologue of a story unfolding, which is going to be the greatest story of all time. The Exodus story retold, of which the original Passover was merely a foreshadowing. Jesus is about to lead the greatest exodus of mankind for all of history. And what this woman is doing is just the opening act. And it's a beautiful act of worship. What she's doing is prophetic. And I don't know if this woman even realizes just how prophetic this act is. But soon the world would know. And her story, this story, would be told. Well, guess what? We're even telling it today. Worship is recognizing that there is someone who is so much greater than ourselves and giving him the glory that is due him. Sometimes when we worship, I think we have no idea just how important and impactful our worship is. It's not about me. It's not about you. Our stories, as interesting as they may be, well, each of our stories is just a piece, just a part of a much greater story. And that story is playing out through us and through our lives, just like it was with this woman. And when you realize that, well, you want to make sure that you're on the right side of history. Jesus had one disciple who was definitely not on the right side of history. Let's talk about loyalty and betrayal. Picking up in verse 14. Then one of the 12, whose name was Judas Iscariot, went to the chief priests and said, "What will you give me if I deliver him over to you?" And they paid him 30 pieces of silver. And from that moment, he sought an opportunity to betray him. Now, on the first day of unleavened bread, the disciples came to Jesus saying, "Where will you have us to prepare for you to eat the Passover?" And he said, "Go into the city to a certain man and say to him, 'The teacher says, my time is at hand. I will keep the Passover at your house with my disciples.'" And the disciples did as Jesus directed them, and they prepared the Passover. And when it was evening, he reclined at the table with the 12. So, in this passage, Jesus' disciples are preparing literally, logistically, preparing to celebrate the Passover. So we're going to celebrate communion. So while we talk about preparing for the Passover, I'm going to have us prepare to celebrate communion. And we are going to move through this story, participating as it's happening. So the other disciples of Jesus are preparing for the celebration of the Exodus from Egypt. They are preparing for the Passover Seder meal. And at the same time, as Matthew is telling the story, Judas is also preparing, setting the stage for what is about to happen. And Judas is looking for a moment, he said. Looking for a big moment. You know, I don't think Judas was so much looking for a big moment for himself as much as he was trying to. He thought he was setting up Jesus to have a big moment. You know, force him to show what he can do. It's no secret. The Bible tells us that many of his disciples wanted him to be a revolutionary, wanted him to take on Rome. Well, Judas is essentially setting up that scenario. Judas probably thought that he was being loyal to Jesus. You know, helping him out a bit. Maybe let me just help him overcome his shyness a bit. But guess what? Judas was really only being loyal to himself. Judas thought he knew better than God. Where have we seen that before in the biblical account? Eden, maybe? Judas had faith in Jesus, but he wasn't following Jesus. You see the difference? He had faith in Jesus, but he wasn't following Jesus. In other words, he wasn't letting Jesus lead him. He was doing his own thing. And here's the next fill in the blank. Faith is not what you say. Ultimately, it's what you do. Let me pick up in verse 21. And as they were eating, Jesus said, "Truly I say to you, one of you will betray me." And they were very sorrowful and began to say to one another, "Is it I, Lord?" And he answered, "He who has dipped his hand in the dish," which, by the way, is a symbol of fellowship, a symbol of closeness, companionship, "he who has dipped his hand in the dish with me will betray me. The Son of Man goes as it is written of him, but woe to that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It would be better for that man if he had not been born." And Judas, who would betray him, answered, "Is it I, Rabbi?" And he said to him, "You've said so." Notice in this passage, Jesus is trying to warn everyone, including Judas, as to what is to happen. Funny how nobody can see it. "Surely not I, Jesus. I would never betray you." We all say that. But what do? Let's face it. Sometimes we all say the right things, but when it comes down to it, we still do whatever we want to do and never consider what he wants. Let's take communion now. So now we come to communion. Imagine you're sitting at the table with Jesus and all of the other disciples. And, well, Jesus seems pretty intense. He's trying to tell us all something very important. So let's just try to be open to what the Lord is saying. Verse 26. Now as they were eating, Jesus took bread. And after he blessed it, he broke it and he gave it to the disciples. And he said, "Take and eat, for this is my body." Now, I usually read the 2 Corinthians text. Paul's quoting right out of this, right out of here. Jesus is saying that this bread, well, it's the bread of the Passover meal, and he said, "It's my body." Well, they are eating the Passover, the unleavened bread, the bread that was urgently made because they are leaving Egypt, the bread that is different from the bread of any other night, as we say in the Passover meal, the bread that symbolizes the Exodus, leaving slavery. So let us partake of the bread together, all the while asking the Lord, "Lord, what does this mean?" Let's partake together. Matthew continues, and he took a cup. And when he had given thanks, he gave it to them, saying, "Drink of it, all of you. For this is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins. And I tell you, I will not drink again of this fruit of the vine until the day when I drink it new with you in my Father's kingdom." Jesus is saying that the Passover cup is his blood. Now, this is the third of four cups which are taken during the Passover meal. It's the cup of redemption. It is salvation, the price which has been paid for our freedom and deliverance. In the Passover story, the price paid for redemption was the blood of the Passover lamb, which is applied to the doorposts. And it showed that blood had already been shed. Death must pass over. You know, there's also a cup of suffering. Jesus drank the cup of suffering and of God's wrath so that we could drink the cup of redemption. So let's partake of this cup together and ask the Lord to reveal to us, "Lord, what does this mean?" You know, the beautiful thing about communion, about the Lord's Supper, is that you can partake of these elements over and over again, and God continues to reveal himself to us through them. And we continue to give ourselves in worship to him. Not only do we recognize who Jesus is, but by partaking, we become part of the story. And that's our next fill in the blank. Real faith is doing what Jesus did. Let me pick up in verse 30. And when they had sung a hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives. And Jesus said to them, "You will all fall away because of me this night. For it is written, 'I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock will be scattered.' But after I am raised up, I will go before you to Galilee." And Peter answered him, "Though they all fall away because of you, I will never fall away." And Jesus said to him, "Truly I tell you, this very night, before the rooster crows, you will deny me 3 times. And Peter said to him, "Even if I must die with you, I will not deny you." And all the disciples said the same. See, loyalty to Christ is not insisting that we have never sinned. It's recognizing that we have and surrendering ourselves anew every time we discover it. You know, Judas was not the only disciple who didn't understand what Jesus was doing. He wasn't the only one who acted on his own inclination instead of obedience to Christ. He was just the only one who never repented and never finally got it right. Peter was adamant that he would never deny Jesus. Well, we all know how that turned out. Peter and Judas and their words and actions stand in direct contrast to those of Jesus. Let's face it, none of us can do what Jesus did if we're doing it in our own strength. So here's the third part of this message. Let's talk about denial of self versus denying Christ. Picking up in verse 36, "Then Jesus went with them to a place called Gethsemane. And he said to his disciples, 'Sit here while I go over there and pray.' And taking with him Peter and 2 sons of Zebedee, he began to be sorrowful and troubled. And he said to them, 'My soul is very sorrowful, even to death. Remain here and watch with me.' And going a little further, he fell on his face and prayed, saying, 'My Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will.'" So if you think to yourself, "Surely I would never deny Jesus," well, ask yourself this: but can I tarry with Jesus? In the 18th century, there was a man named John Wesley, and he founded the Methodist movement. The early Methodists focused on a practice of what they called tarrying for the Spirit. They would spend hours in prayer, seeking a deeper encounter with God's presence. And this commitment transformed their lives and their communities. And today, that same invitation to tarry with Jesus remains, calling us to a deeper intimacy with Him. Now, if we reflect on Wesley's example, we can ask ourselves how we can reclaim that time, pursuing a profound relationship with Christ that is life-changing. You know, tarrying is essentially identifying with Jesus. It's allowing ourselves to feel what He feels. It's allowing ourselves to wrestle through the tension of conflicting thoughts and emotions. It's allowing ourselves to work through all of the scenarios of what could happen until we finally come to that conclusion, just as Jesus did, that nothing we can imagine is better than what God wants for us. It's the complete and final surrender of our will to God. And here's the next fill in the blank. Identifying with Jesus means denying yourself. Denying yourself. Verse 40, "And he came to the disciples and he found them sleeping. And he said to Peter, 'So you could not watch with me for 1 hour. Watch and pray that you may not enter into temptation. The spirit is indeed willing, but the flesh is weak.' And again for the second time he went away and prayed, 'My Father, if this cannot pass unless I drink it, your will be done.' And again he came and found them sleeping, for their eyes were heavy." The disciples couldn't do it. They couldn't hang with Jesus when it comes to that kind of sacrifice. And it's no wonder they all fell asleep. You know, it wears me out just thinking about it. Jesus is wrestling with the idea of going to the cross, and his disciples can't fight sleep. Do you think you could do it? Alan, you've done lots of physical mastery. Do you have the kind of mastery over your own body to be able to stay awake when you're completely exhausted? What if it's not just sleep? What if it's really the spiritual battle that's going on? What if the heaviness in their eyelids is really just a manifestation of that heaviness of spirit? You know, I'm sure Carrie and maybe others of you can identify that I have felt that sometimes when I have sat with counselees. Like, I'll be sitting with somebody and they are sharing something, and I'm having a hard time paying attention because what I am feeling is even heavier than what they are sharing. There are times when I literally have to force my eyes open while talking with them just so I'm not being rude. And then when we're done, I need immediately to take a nap. Because what they are sharing is so heavy, I can't even keep myself awake listening. I'm sure that whatever my clients have faced is nothing compared to what Jesus was facing in Gethsemane. However, following Jesus does involve identifying with his suffering and sometimes even with the suffering of others, as I was doing, trying to keep my eyes open. Luke 9:23, and Jesus said to all, "If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me." What Jesus did, he did for us because we could not do it. And then Jesus calls us to do what we can only do in his strength. In taking up our cross, we are taking up his cross. And the only reason when we can bear our cross is because he first bore it for us. And we are not doing anything that he did not already do. So don't be like Judas or Peter, thinking you got this and Jesus is just following your lead. You don't got this. That's the point. He got this, and he got you. And that's the only reason you can say you got this. You got it? One more fill in the blank. Following the world means denying Christ. Verse 44. So leaving them again, he went away and he prayed for a third time, saying the same words again. And he came to the disciples and said to them, sleep and take your rest later on. See, the hour is at hand, and the Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand. You know, this lesson has been a lesson in contrasts, and it's a lesson for all of us. Living in this world will force you to take sides. You will either deny yourself or you will deny Jesus. Following Jesus is going to go against everything that may seem normal or right to you sometimes. And you're going to feel the conflict, the tension of contradictions in your own mind and in your own heart. Do I keep up the right appearances, or do I worship with abandonment? Do I play along with the power games that the world plays, or do I surrender all to Jesus? Do I say all the right things and then act only in my own interest? Or do I lay my life down like Jesus, only to find a strength that really doesn't even come from me? Following Jesus, well, it may look easy until you get to Passion Week. And then it gets really confusing, because Jesus is moving toward the cross. And everything in us wants to go the other way. So my question to us is, will you live like Jesus with passion? Pat, you can come on up. Let's consider our questions for reflection. You can take these with you this week and think and pray about them. Number one, when you think about the fellowship of sharing in Christ's suffering, what does that mean to you? Where have you experienced the tension of conflicting thoughts, emotions, and desires? And how has Christ revealed himself to you in those moments? Here's another way of asking essentially the same question. What does it mean to you to identify with Christ? What kind of crosses have you had to bear? And what does it mean to do this in Christ's strength? Where has following Christ taken you that you might not otherwise go? Let me ask a third way, perhaps a little more boldly. Has your Christianity been primarily a matter of keeping up the right appearances, or of doing what Jesus did? Now, I'm not asking you if you know the right answer. I know you know the right answer. The question is, what have you actually done? Let's worship the Lord together as we think about these things.